All right, so we know that we're gonna have our exam tomorrow, and it's gonna go all the way back to, I was going back, I actually listened to the first lecture before spring break, and it goes all the way back to JFK. I didn't realize that we covered a lot, but I got a little more I gotta cover because we're gonna see if I can get through 1966, because the stuff up to 1966 is on the exam. All right. Simple. We know that beginning of 1966, Westmoreland was changing the game. And he started using, like we saw in the video last class, Operation Mosby. Essentially, you'd have the Huey helicopters would basically fly in, drop off a landing team. They would protect the LZ, the landing zone. And then more troops would be brought in. Helicopters would patrol in the air and serve as gunships. And the soldiers would fan out and conduct operations in remote parts of the country. But as we said, the flaw with that was that you could basically hear the bad guys coming. So the enemy did not remain static. They didn't come out of their camouflage and attack and fight. But instead, like I have up here, they were fluid, flowing water. So just where you thought they were there, they weren't. And where you thought they weren't, they were there. Now, the reason for this occurred was because how Hanoi was fighting. They knew that they could not beat the United States one-on-one. But they wanted the war to escalate. They wanted to basically result in more death. So, beginning around the same time America starts ramping up, more and more troops come down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And these weren't VC wearing their little black pajamas. These were NVA regulars. So they had their pith helmets and they had their green uniforms. I've showed many pictures. Give me no more pictures. I gotta finish the class. I don't have much time left. Plus, you got essays I gotta grade. But I've showed you pictures of the VC. I mean the NVA regulars. And what's the difference? Well, very simple. The NVA were professionally trained soldiers. They went to boot camp. They engaged in PT. They studied tactics. Whereas the VC were more like militia fighters. So what does this mean? Well, they were an army in the truest sense of a word. The NVA also would study tactics. And the leaders in the NVA quickly realized them marching out onto the battlefield would be foolish. But instead, what they mastered was basically tricking the United States soldiers to walk into concealed ambushes. One of the favorite tactics was, almost like bait, convince the United States soldiers to progress in a path into a remote region. But unbeknownst to them, you would be pre in place, either on high ground or in thick foliage. And just as the Americans had entered the kill zone, you would basically unleash fire. But you wouldn't stay till you killed them all. Once you ambushed them, you would quickly retreat and go back into the jungles. So when the American reinforcements came in and swept the area, there was nothing there. Death came out of nowhere. The other thing that they would do, close quarter fighting. You can have tanks and artillery, but what good is a tank if the bad guy runs up right on the side? Have you ever watched a video of a tank turret moving? It's usually really slow, and you only can see out in the front. So the NVA would be experts on really getting right up on top of the enemy and killing them at short range. But that didn't mean that they were the most powerful fighting force on earth. They were not. They had many weaknesses. One of the ironies was that they were better defensively than offensively. Why? Well, the biggest reason is their commanders. They were all divided, they all had egos, and they were unable to coordinate unified movements. So you'd have one unit that would march in and engage the Americans over here, but they would have to retreat because reinforcements would never come. So like any military force, they had things they were good at and things they weren't. But what they could not do is they didn't have the ability to sweep the Americans from the field. But as bad as that was, they also had a huge flaw. Logistics. The Americans had the ability to move men and material, food, medicines, by the ton. The NVA, they didn't have that ability. Because the Americans were flying reconnaissance missions in the air, and they were looking down. The Americans were engaged in bombing raids. So typically what happens if you go into a fight, you have your medical tent that's behind wherever the lines are. So if your soldiers are firing and someone's injured, you pull the injured man back. Well, the problem with the North Vietnamese, the NVA, is in order for them to attack American positions, they had to kind of put the food and supplies close to the Americans beforehand, because they didn't have the ability to simply march in as a big army and get close. And what was the problem with that? Well, they could never have enough. The NVA used to refer to it as feathering the nest in advance. But of course, this meant they were always vulnerable to spoiling operations. And the NVA never had artillery. The Americans had massive artillery capabilities. They had mortars, they had guns, they had tanks. The Americans had the ability to essentially blow up anything. But what did this mean? Well, if this is our base, our fire base, and we have big guns here, as the enemy starts charging at us out of the jungles, all the Americans need to do is zero their guns in and blow us up. So the result was, is whenever the North Vietnamese would attack U.S. positions, it always was a bloodbath. So I have one military story that my father told me, and he's only told me one. He was trapped inside of a tank, because his primary job was a tank retriever. So if a tank got a tread blow off, he would actually have to go out and kind of help him. Well, he gets into the tank with the crew, and he's there for 2 weeks, constantly hearing like popcorn, blink, 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 small arms fire on the side of the tank. And every now and then, the American crew would like turn the gun, fire machine guns, or fire the big gun and basically blow them up. By the time the reinforcements come to get the tank and the crew out, they went out and they surveyed the land around the tank. 300 dead NVA regulars. They all died trying to take off the tank. They had nothing big enough to take the tank out. Now, if they had an artillery gun, they could just zone it in and they could blow them all up. Another flaw, the soldiers themselves. Most of the NVA soldiers were drafted, just like the Americans. But they were peasants. They grew up in farming villages. In order for them to get from the north to the south, they had to travel the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and I already talked about that. You're going through the middle of rainforests. No food. No like rest stop areas. No south of the border. But there were bugs, mosquitoes that spread malaria. There were poisonous snakes. There was contaminated water. Plus, the Americans, beginning in 66, started constantly bombing in and around where they believed the Ho Chi Minh was. So just to get from the north to the south, you had to march through this death route for 3 months. Then you get into the south, and you're essentially in a foreign country. And if you are in a foreign country, there are hazards to fighting in foreign countries. Because just like the United States couldn't tell which Vietnamese peasant was VC and which was not, the NVA didn't know which peasant was VC and which was not. There were political cadres down there that basically told them that they would be warm welcomed by the people. But the truth be told is many of the people in the South Vietnam didn't want there to be war, period. Villagers were just as willing to help the NVA as they were willing to report them. Which meant that they were always in danger of being discovered. And unlike an American soldier who would be drafted and fight a one-year term, if you were drafted into the NVA, you were in it for the duration of the war. So one of the mottos by the NVA soldiers was born in the north to die in the south. Well, how do they keep them loyal? Well, indoctrination. And direct supervision. Soldiers essentially would be bound together into a single squad. They were encouraged to get rid of their previous loyalties to their families, to their friends, and instead transfer it to the army and the revolution. Every single army unit or division or brigade, they actually had political spies operating in them. And if a soldier looked like he was homesick, he could be arrested and he could be shot. Soldiers had to show that they were completely devoted to the cause. At its base, they were put in what were called three-man cells. You would be put together with two men, and you were responsible for the behavior of the other two men. So what did this mean? Well, if one of your buddies was talking smack about Uncle Ho, you reported them because the whole cell could be punished. Well, as a result, these inducements, this brainwashing, this indoctrination, this also explains why the NVA, when they actually were on the battlefield, they enjoyed high levels of success. Because basically they had no other choice. So the only way for you to go home is to win. If you don't win, you might as well die because you're not going home. And you got to remember, unlike us, who have no concept of our history, the people in Vietnam were taught their history going back centuries. And we talked about it in the beginning, how originally they were a small kingdom, but then the small kingdoms conquered one another. Then the Chinese came in and conquered them. But then they fought and they rebelled and they won their independence. But then they were divided. And then the French came in and they were conquered. It's just exploitation. But the common cause of Vietnamese history is resistance. So, the Vietnamese were basically taught, okay, this war sucks, but if we continue to fight, we will win because we always win. It's just a matter of when. So, you had a formidable enemy that pound for pound appeared on paper not to be a match of the American fighting man. But truth be told, their hearts were into it, unlike our boys. That explains why, by 1966, this was one of the most bizarre wars in the history of the United States. Wars, every single war that we've ever fought, there always was a front, a line. We're on our side, the bad guys are on the other side. But in Vietnam, that was not the case. There was no line because all of these battles were being fought in South Vietnam. The VC, as I've said many times, for an American soldier, you couldn't tell the difference between one Vietnamese person and another. Talk to a combat vet who served in country. Call them all gooks. Plus, it's not like they paraded through the streets. They were always in the jungles or in the valleys or in the mountains. You knew they were there, but you couldn't know exactly when. And ultimately, it was the enemy that controlled the war, not the Americans. At any moment in time, the VC and the NVA could come out of the jungles and strike an American base, cause havoc, and then retreat. At any point, a squad could ambush an American squad in the jungles, fire a bunch of bullets, kill a few, disappear. And as we said last class, you could try going out and finding where the enemy was, but they were never there. Or at least where you thought they were. And to make matters worse, the NVA were willing to die for their cause. You think some American kid from a farm or another American kid from the inner city or some kid from a suburb that gets drafted, flies halfway across the earth, you think they want to die for that cause? Oh, they just don't want to get their ass shot, and they want to get home. They want to be able to go home, hang out with all the hippies, smoke pot, and listen to Led Zeppelin. In adding to the shock, again, if you have a chance, watch When We Were Soldiers with Mel Gibson. Watch that movie. I don't know what streaming service is on. But you will see what I'm talking about this human wave attack. The way that they did the movie was brilliant. Wave after wave after wave of the VC came. And when the sun finally came up, all you can see is dead enemy. But the Americans knew they didn't kill them all, because the next day they would come back again. If you are an American farm boy, suburban, inner city kid, and you are out in those firefighting, you're just thinking, my God, these people are insane. And worse still, some American soldiers and generals and officers began seeing the fanaticism almost in a heroic sense. Marine Lieutenant William Boyles Jr. said, and I quote, when he appeared before Congress, "In our minds, the enemy wasn't another soldier, wasn't a man like us. He was a mysterious and elusive. He was a vision from the unknown, a boogeyman with terrible powers, rising up out of the earth. And the primitive methods that the enemy adapted in the face of our technology made him that much more formidable. When you attack a tank with rocks and you're able to knock the tread off, you get bad respect." But not all Vietnamese were the same. No. Because the ARVN was still around, the Army of the Republic of Vietnam, the South Vietnamese troops. While the Americans are watching in awe with what the North Vietnamese is doing, they're looking at their Southern Vietnamese so-called allies, and they're getting furious at them. It seemed like the ARVN soldiers were fine wearing the uniforms, like walking around with the guns, but they were not fighting to die for their country. That boy from the farm, that boy from the inner city, that boy from the suburbs. Pardon my language, but why the fuck are we here when their own people aren't fighting for their freedom? Countless incidents were reported throughout 66 and 67 and into 68, where the ARVN troops were deployed but retreated, refusing to attack the enemy. And the sad part was initially, the American soldiers and Marines and sailors, they were all in on this. They had high expectations. They believed they were fighting for freedom. Most commanders believed with Westmoreland's strategy: mass casualties until the enemy quits. But again, what's on paper isn't always how things turn out. The enemy was elusive. Kid you not, my father said it rained for 5 months straight. You're fighting in jungles and streams that flood, on dirt paths that wash out. There are bugs and animals that could kill you. And the peasants hated you. The South Vietnamese people out in the jungles, in the villages, they viewed you as colonizers. So do you want to see how you really break the morale of somebody? I'll show you. Every time United States soldier, I'll just click this, that'll be the easiest thing to do because I already got it loaded. Every time an American soldier went out into the jungles, this is what he had to face.
During the Vietnam War, a number of ingenious, cruel, and devastating traps were employed by the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong forces. Unable to match the military capabilities of the United States, the North turned to rudimentary, effective, and utterly terrifying ways to incapacitate and kill enemy soldiers. In today's video, we will look into some of the types of traps used and the devastation they caused, and in some instances, still cause to this day. Perhaps the most infamous of the traps used is also one of their simplest. Punji sticks, that is bamboo sharpened to a point, were placed into pits. Rows of the sharp stakes were then hidden by a false floor, camouflaged to look like the jungle floor. These traps would be placed onto routes or paths where it was known that American forces would be traveling through. Upon stepping on the tarp or collection of sticks, an American soldier would fall and be impaled. Those that did not die instantly would no doubt scream in pain, alerting their enemy to their position. The injured soldier would be difficult to rescue, taking multiple soldiers out of action as they tried to help their comrade. But this is not the end of the matter. Innovations to the spike traps were varied. In some instances, human or animal waste was smeared on the punji sticks, thereby greatly increasing the chances of a serious infection for the wounded man. In other instances, the punji sticks, rather than pointing upward, would be pointed at a downward angle. This would create a situation where once a person had entered the pit, it would be almost impossible to get out without impaling oneself. Some of the spike pits were elaborate, such as pits with rotating spike-covered logs or contraptions akin to bear traps. The latter would involve two planks of spiked wood that, if stepped on, would cause the leg to fall down and the spikes to impale as the trap was sprung. It wasn't just spikes that would be found in the pits, but also venomous snakes. The bamboo pit fiber was commonly used, often hundreds at a time, left for unwitting troops. A person falling into the pit would disturb the already agitated and hungry snakes, causing many to attack the unlucky soul. In fact, the bamboo pit fiber became almost standard issue for the Viet Cong forces. The snakes were commonly used as a booby trap in Viet Cong's backpacks, as a means to kill or injure those who dare to rummage through. These fibers were also used in the labyrinth network of underground tunnels used by the North Vietnamese forces, and were often tied to the walls as a form of guard. Another simple and cheap-to-make trap was the mace. This would be made from either a wooden or dried mud ball with a number of spikes protruding. The mace would be suspended and held in place with a trip wire. Once triggered, the gravitational force would come crashing down onto the unsuspecting soldier. A similar device was the bamboo whip. Rather than using gravity, the bamboo whip exploited the tensile strength of bamboo. On one end of the bamboo pole would be a number of sharpened spikes. The trap would be held in place by a tripwire and could be placed at varying heights. At lower levels, the spike could impale and cripple a person's legs. At higher levels, the whip would be able to pierce a person's neck or chest. The benefits of such weapons is that they could be made using only what materials were found in the jungles. More conventional weapons were also employed, though some taking a rather different shape. The grenade in a can, as it sounds, involved two tin cans and usually two grenades. The safety pins on the grenades would be removed before being put into cans, in a way that would hold down the striker lever. A trip wire was then fastened to each grenade and the device placed along paths, usually hidden in trees. When the wire was tripped, the grenades would be pulled out of the cans, causing an instant detonation. Not only would the shrapnel from the grenades be sent flying, but so too would be the metal fragments from the tins. All manner of landmines were employed by the Viet Cong. One of the simplest and perhaps hardest to detect was the cartridge trap. It was in many ways similar to the pit traps, only far smaller, making it ever harder to spot. The cartridge trap would be formed by a single round of ammunition set with a nail underneath. The nail acted as a makeshift firing pin. A board would be placed over the hole so that when stepped on, would cause the victim's foot to cause the bullet to fire. In many instances, the bullet would tear through the foot, disabling the soldier. If a larger caliber of bullet was used, it could be fatal. More conventional landmines were also used, supplied from the Viet Cong allies in China and the Soviet Union. But French-made mines from the earlier First Indochina War and repurposed American mines too were used. Such mines proved devastating against American forces, with around 64,000 soldiers killed or injured by landmines during the war. The effects of landmines, however, would last long after the war. Still to this day, mines planted by all sides kill indiscriminately. Between the landmines and other unexploded ordnance, over 100,000 casualties have been recorded, with around 35,000 killed. Then, there is the cost involved in removing landmines. It is relatively easy to plant a landmine. It is far more dangerous and costly to remove it. And the presence of Agent Orange residue in the soil means that uncovering the mines can sometimes result in exposure to the deadly agent. The Viet Cong and North Vietnamese forces had little hope in fighting a more conventional war against the United States. Vastly outgunned, the communist forces utilized all manner of traps to hinder the American forces. By crippling soldiers with brutal traps, the effect on morale and the resources expended in rescuing injured soldiers was how the Viet Cong could measure success. American soldiers had to be on constant alert for traps, many of which could only be detected by careful observation. It is estimated that around 11% of all deaths and 15% of all wounds to American soldiers were caused by such booby traps and mines, meaning that tens of thousands were affected. There is little doubt that war is hell, but the traps employed by the Viet Cong resonate, perhaps due to their rudimentary build and brutal effective methods of causing casualties. Whilst the massive bombing campaigns, the deployment of toxic agents, and the widespread use of napalm are associated with American attempts at victory, so too do the variety of Viet Cong traps typify the cruelty of the Vietnam War. We do have a number of videos focusing on Vietnam, such as the effects of Agent Orange, the fate of Napalm Girl, along with other massacres that occurred. Be sure to check out the channel.
So you don't need planes and tanks to fight the enemy. You use sticks. You use pits. Grenade in a can. Whatever it takes. In the end, it's the same. You kill them. Or if you can't kill them, you maim them. Because that has a psychological effect. And if your enemy believes every single step could be death in a cause that they're not committed to, are they going to want to fight? And we will talk about these. There actually were a few set-piece battles where the enemy was on one side and the other army was on the other. But they were far and few in between. Because truth be told, this war was nothing like the officers had prepared the soldiers for. This was not World War II. This was not Korea. There was no clear direction, there was no momentum, there was no safe region to defend. The enemy was everywhere. There were no theaters to operate in. And ultimately, the only way to gauge success, because you're not occupying towns and, you know, territories and pushing the line forward, was death. But the problem is, as you're killing the enemy, they're killing you as well. And there was redundancy. One of the veterans at the Legion post that I'm a member of, combat veteran of Vietnam, He told me in his tour, he was stationed outside in Da Nang. He went 37 times, 37 operations, and they made the same basic loop. And as he always said, they were there, but they never were there. So, the Americans constantly, if you read the diaries or you talk to veterans, they basically felt that there really was no objective. They were fighting, but they were fighting for nothing because there was nothing to win. And it was constant. I mentioned this last class. In World War I, it's estimated that a typical American soldier saw at most 17 days of combat. That's it. So you'd go over there for a year, and at most 17 days. In World War II, at most 40 days. In Vietnam, 240 days out of 365. Give you a story that was conveyed by Colonel Harold Moore, Mel Gibson, when we were soldiers. I told you, Westmoreland at the beginning of 1966 divided Vietnam into three zones. The zone around Hue, the coastal region, and then around Saigon. Moore spent much of 66 in Zone 2. The coastland lowlands. Lots of people, densely populated, because that's where most of the rice was grown. So if you ever see like an image on TV or on the internet of soldiers going through rice paddies, this is what he faced for a year. He led a brigade into the region and constantly battled NVA regulars. But after heavy fighting, his unit prevailed. The enemy seemingly retreated from the battlefield. Well, Moore believed that the area was secure, so he pulled his men out, only to learn 2 weeks later that the enemy was back again. In the course of a month, he had to return to the same place two more times. And then in his report, he said, how could the U.S. ever win if the South Vietnamese government could not establish control in such a newly cleared area? We swept the field, but they didn't keep it. And then we swept it again, and they didn't keep it. And then we swept it again. So as a result, U.S. combat soldiers were confused, to say the least. They were young. They were hardworking, good, decent boys, your age, from all different types of backgrounds. But, like all of you, could you imagine being forced on a plane, flown halfway across the world, dropped in some country, and say, have at it? They knew nothing about Vietnam. Ironically, like you guys, you don't even know what happened 10 years ago or 20 years ago. The soldiers that were fighting in Vietnam, they knew that there was a war there against the French, but they didn't know what it was about or why it was fought or how it was fought. They knew nothing about how the United States even got involved. All that stuff we talked about during the Eisenhower administration was classified. It wasn't in the newspapers, as was much of the stuff in the beginning of the Kennedy administration. They pretty much only knew what was going on from LBJ onward. And by that time, we had already been involved in Vietnam for what?
20 years?
They had no idea.
And as the war continued, the myths that they went into the war with seemingly disappeared.
Young soldiers deployed in country, arriving in Vietnam for their first days of their first tour. The only thing of war they knew was the stuff that they saw in John Wayne movies. John Wayne. I'm assuming you've all heard of the actor John Wayne.
If you go and look, there was a whole bunch of John Wayne movies where John Wayne was the hero in all of the different battles in World War II, and then in the years past Korea, suddenly he was a hero in Korea as well. And the amazing thing, John Wayne was the hero. He would stand up tall and say, "Let's go get him, boys!" And he would run real quickly, and he would be shooting at the bad guys. Amazingly, bad guys never hit him, but they all fell down dead. And it was easy to win because you just got to be an American. And that will give you victory.
Have any of you ever been shot at? Really? Someone shot a bullet at you?
I said no.
Oh. I thought you were like me.
I have. Not in combat.
Wait, you said I've been when you've been shot?
Yeah. Have you ever been shot at? No, no. Has anyone ever fired a gun at you?
In the crowd, I was saying, yeah.
How did you feel?
Your adrenaline starts rushing, and you gotta start running.
Why?
So you don't get hit.
Oh, yeah. I got shot at once, too. I was in a bad place. I'm not lying. I thought I was gonna pee my pants. It's just the most terrifying thing. Because all you hear is the... You see the wall go... What the hell was that? Yeah, but...
Or get low.
But if you are in a battle, where are you going to run to?
Yeah, true.
So these guys were like, oh, if I'm brave and I charge the enemy, I'm going to be able to go home.
Ironically, the highest percentage of casualties ranked within the guys that were there in the first 3 months.
War is not on TV. War is not like on video games. You don't get to respawn.
But not every soldier felt the same way. Some, they were into it. I've talked to veterans that loved it. And honestly, they would say if they could go back and do it again, they would do it without second thought. Because they felt alive. You ever meet someone who's just an adrenaline junkie? But there were also some who lost their minds. That became delusioned. They lost faith. So, my father did his tour. Psychologically, he was not ready to come back. So he volunteered and did a second tour. After the second tour, he told me he just felt spent. There was no debriefing. There was no PTSD training or observations. When you were done with your tour, you got put on a plane. You were flown out of Vietnam. You went to either Guam or Hawaii. He was a Marine, so from there, then they flew him to San Diego. He gets on base, some officer stamps a whole bunch of papers, and say, here you go, you're done, son. There were no parades, there were no pageants. He simply walked off the base. He was lost, he didn't know what to do. He didn't even call home. He couldn't call my grandmother. Well, they got paid, but it just went into a bank account. But no, it's not like, here you go, here's a $50,000 check. It was just like, not even a thank you, he said. Just, here you go. So he spent a few months just trying to make sense. 3 days before, he was in Vietnam. And then suddenly he finds himself in San Diego. 1969. He just went and found a bar, drank, got some pot, got stoned, kind of fell into the hippie crowd for a couple of months, and then suddenly realized, I gotta go home. Hitchhiked his way across the country, showed up at my grandparents' house, unannounced, and was like, I'm back. He could not make sense of it. There was no way to process what he just went through. But now suddenly he was supposed to get a job, go work 9 to 5, carry a little lunch pail, go work for the band. He just couldn't connect. Met my mother in a hippie commune, knocked her up. They got married, but got divorced 2 months before I was born. Because he just couldn't handle it. He went and disappeared for 5 months. Came back, signed the divorce papers, disappeared for a few more years. I met my father for the first time when I was 6. No, sorry, strike that, I was 8. And you know how I met him? He called me up on my birthday. And I remember this. He said, hi, I'm your father. I did not even know I had a father. I was 8 years old. There was never dad, I didn't know. No. And you know what the first thing he said to me other than, hi, I'm your father? Congratulations, you got a brother. Handed the phone to my mother. They talked. I ended up going to his house. I was there. I slept over. And then I didn't see him again for another 5 years. Not every single soldier came back home. They all had damage. They just didn't show.
How could you let, why did he leave?
What?
Why did he leave?
From what he told me later, my mother flipped out on him, demanded, because they had been talking, I didn't realize that. She had been forcing him to pay child support. And when I came back, I had like a whole bunch of presents. Because my birthday is the same day as my brother. I guess I could say my 8-year birthday was my brother. It was my present. But dad was trying to reconnect. My mother didn't want it to him. So she took him to court again and basically said she couldn't see me again. But the court said it couldn't be for 5 more years. So at 13, they went back to court and my father got visitation. But at that point, I'm a 13-year-old kid. I didn't want to have a dad. So I really didn't bond with my father until I was 20. And I don't blame him. As a kid, I did, but I've studied. I've talked to lots of veterans. I get it now. Plus this, when the Americans came home from World War II, they were met with parades. They were called heroes. There was patriotism. There was red, white, and blue flags everywhere. Women practically jumped the soldiers as they came off the trains in uniform. In Vietnam, that's not the case. Not only were the peasants hostile, but when the soldiers came home, they were called things like baby killers. They were spat on. They were assaulted by the counterculture. War is definitely hell. Questions? All right, let's wrap up the little bit that we got left. All right, well, as things were getting out of control and the nature of the war was expanding and changing, LBJ decided to press on. But whereas initially he was like Kennedy, and he was trying to get opinions from all sides, by 1966, it appeared that he started ignoring his advisors that had skept skepticism in terms of our ability to actually win this war. So instead, he ignored the skeptics and only listened to the optimists. For example, 1966, he promotes Walter W. Rostow as National Security Advisor. Roswell frequently told LBJ, "We can win if," and I quote, "we pour it on and see if we can't use force in the months ahead to achieve a resolution." So the only way to win is to send more soldiers, to fire more artillery shells, to drop more bombs. Which, of course, to bring it full circle, means more American soldiers are going to be impacted. And Westmoreland was game for this. He constantly was sending reports back saying, "Give me 20,000 more soldiers, give me 30,000 more soldiers." His biggest request came in October of 66 when he said, "Give me 65,000 more soldiers." Why? Well, the more soldiers he had, the more seek and destroy missions he could launch on larger scales. And as proof positive that this strategy was reporting, Westmoreland also started reporting a spike in enemy casualties. But when you look at the spike in enemy casualties, guess what's in the next column? A spike in our own. LBJ wants follow-up. He wants proof that what Westmoreland is doing is working. And he got it. He continued to get it. Henry Cabot Lodge, still serving as U.S. Vietnamese ambassador. He goes back to Vietnam in in the summer of 66. And he reports, yeah, the enemy's morale is declining. And he can smell the air of victory when he walks through the streets of Saigon. In his report, he actually said this: "We are not losing. We cannot lose in the normal sense of the word. Never have things been going so well." Why? Well, rose-colored lenses. Stories start appearing in the American newspapers hinting that the people in South Vietnam are finally on board. In September of 66, they had an election. They filled their parliament. It had the highest voter turnout of all the elections in the Republic of Vietnam. This new body sets to work on building a new constitution. They promise rights for the people and a lot of social programs, which they agreed to in the Honolulu Declaration. Everything looks good. And simultaneously, LBJ begins putting feelers out to Hanoi. Like I said last class, you contact a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend, and eventually word will get to Hanoi. But the problem is in 1966, they were in the same place as they were in 65, which was the same place they were in 64. Hanoi wanted the same three things: U.S. stop bombing, U.S. out, and allow the VC in the peace process. DC insisted no bombing until the NVA is out. Plus, US not withdraw. And US not recognize the VC as a legitimate political group. So this is you wanting plain pizza and me wanting Hawaiian pizza. Not that I ever would. I'm going to flip that. You want Hawaiian pizza. You like that wacky shit. Me, I'm having the plain pizza. No compromise. And the worst part is the more the United States said no to Hanoi, and the more Hanoi said no to the United States, it got to the point when neither side began answering those distant requests. But LBJ made a mistake. Instead of listening to the optimists, he should have listened to McNamara. Two months after Lodge does the rose-colored report of everything is going great, McNamara goes back to Vietnam for his seventh trip. And in his report, I think he says this. No, it does not. Sorry, I didn't know what was next. He says, and I quote, "I see no reasonable way to bring this war to an end." He saw no sudden spike in morale in the South Vietnam. He saw no collapse of morale with the enemy. All he saw was Westmoreland getting more men, sending more men out into the jungles, and more body bags coming home. In October, in his report, McNamara actually put it in paper. He said, "Mr. President, we need to stop bombing North Vietnam. We need to bring the VC into the peace. And when the fighting ends, we need to bring all U.S. forces home." In other words, we have to meet Hanoi halfway. But then he also did something weird. At the same time, he's basically telling LBJ we can't win. He also gives in to pressure from Westmoreland and others. In October 66, the Department of Defense launches what's known as Project 100,000. This was a controversial move to increase recruitment. Now, in case you're not aware, in order to go into the military, you have to first take an aptitude test. If you bomb the aptitude test, you're not getting in, even if you want to volunteer. And then, if you do well on the aptitude test, you then still have to take a physical test. So when I tried getting into the Marine Corps when I was 17, I think I had to be able to run, I think it was like a 5 or a 6 minute mile. I had to be able to do 100 push-ups in 2 minutes. I think I had to do a similar amount of sit-ups. I don't know, there was a whole bunch of things that I had to do. I was beast mode. Did it. I did it. But then once you do all the physical... Oh, by the way, I took my military aptitude test. I got the highest score in my school. I could have gone into any branch I wanted to. Physically prepared. I was beast. After I passed the physical, then I got all my medical examinations done. And as I told you, I was sectioned eight. I'm tonally deaf. Yeah, I can't hear all tones in my right ear. If you can't hear, even though I did everything else well by today, well, standards back then, you don't go in. No, not anymore. Secretary Hegseth is raising all the standards. But I could have gotten in if Project 100,000 was there. Because what did they do? They lowered the military aptitude test. You could only get in if you scored in the top 10%. They lowered it down to 40%. Physical standards were lowered. Medical standards were lowered. No longer did you have to speak English. No longer did you have to be psychologically stable. You could actually have minor physical impairments. A little too much chunk around the waist, a little too thin, didn't matter. The positive thing was, as a result of Project 100,000, in 2 years, recruitment increased by 350,000. The problem was the death rate of the soldiers that came in under these standards were 3 times likely to die. Slower, dumber soldiers result in more body bags. And even worse, studies that were conducted in the 1980s and 90s show that the men that were recruited under these standards had, they were more likely than non-vets, so people who didn't even join the military, to be able to get a job, to remain employed, to have a decent standard of living. More often than not, they would be either underemployed or unemployed. They also were more likely to have mental issues, to have abuse problems, drug addicts, alcoholics. So if you ever see a homeless vet on the streets saying, "I fought in Vietnam," it's probably one of the guys that came in under this. So they got more bodies. They couldn't use them. All right. I've got a little left, but I am not going to the wire. So we'll call it that, and I'll just pick up the stuff on Thursday. So, actually, I just got to remember not to include Manila. I think I had one question on the Manila conference, so I won't put that in there. So, as I said last week, your exam is tomorrow.
Online.
Yep. It's your last online exam. So it will open up at 8 a.m. and it will remain open until 11:59. It's the same lengths as exam 1 and 2, 30 multiple choice questions, 2 essay questions, you pick one of the ones inside.
You said it was 2 essay questions?
Remember how last time there were 2 essays that came up, but within each essay there were options?
Yeah.
So it's going to be just like that again. So if you answer one of the choices in one of the essay questions, that's worth the first 10 points. And the second one technically is your bonus. To put it another way, I'll probably give you 4 essays. You pick 2. You can get 110 points if you do it perfect.
You
can't. I'm only going to grade the first answer. Okay. Plus, if you try answering all 4 essays, you're probably going to run out of time. All right, any questions? All right, well, for the people who missed it, which was half the class, they're probably not going to take the exam anyway, so it means I'll have an easier time grading it this time. But for you all, good luck. If you have any questions, send me an email.